Chapter 39. Because the red rose was the badge of the House of Lancaster, and the white rose was the badge of the House of York, the Duke of York, joined by some other powerful noblemen of the White Rose Party, and leading a small army, met the king with another small army at St. Albans, and demanded that the Duke of Somerset should be given up. The poor king, being made to say in answer that he would sooner die, was instantly attacked. The Duke of Somerset was killed, and the king himself was wounded in the neck, and took refuge in the house of a poor tanner. Whereupon, the Duke of York went to him, led him with great submission to the abbey, and said he was very sorry for what had happened. Having now the king in his possession, he got a parliament summoned and himself once more made protector, but only for a few months. For, on the king getting a little better again, the queen and her party got him into their possession, and disgraced the duke once more. So, now the Duke of York was down again. Some of the best men in power, seeing the danger of these constant changes, tried even then to prevent the red and the white rose wars. They brought about a great council in London between the two parties. The white roses assembled in Blackfriars, the red roses in Whitefriars, and some good priests communicated between them, and made the proceedings known at evening to the king and the judges. They ended in a peaceful agreement, that there should be no more quarreling, and there was a great royal procession to St. Paul's, in which the queen walked arm in arm with her old enemy, the Duke of York, to show the people how comfortable they all were. This state of peace lasted half a year, when a dispute between the Earl of Warwick, one of the Duke's powerful friends, and some of the king's servants at court, led to an attack upon that earl who was a white rose, and to a sudden breaking out of all old animosities. So, here were greater ups and downs than ever. There were even greater ups and downs than these, soon after. After various battles, the Duke of York fled to Ireland, and his son the Earl of marched to Calais, with their friends the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick, and a parliament was held declaring them all traitors. Little the worse for this, the Earl of Warwick presently came back, landed in Kent, was joined by the Archbishop of Canterbury, and other powerful noblemen and gentlemen, engaged the king's forces at Northampton, signally defeated them, and took the king himself prisoner, who was found in his tent. Warwick would have been glad, I dare say, to have taken the queen and prince too, but they escaped into Wales and thence into Scotland. The king was carried by the victorious force straight to London, and made to call a new parliament, which immediately declared that the Duke of York and those other noblemen were not traitors, but excellent subjects. Then, back comes the Duke from Ireland at the head of 500 horsemen, rides from London to Westminster, and enters the House of Lords. There, he laid his hand upon the cloth of gold which covered the empty throne, as if he had half a mind to sit down in it, but he did not. On the Archbishop of Canterbury, asking him if he would visit the king, who was in his palace close by, he replied, I know no one in this country, my lord, who ought not to visit me. Apostrophe None of the lords present spoke a single word. So, the Duke went out as he had come in, established himself royally in the king's palace, and, 6 days afterwards, sent into the lords a formal statement of his claim to the throne. The lords went to the king on this momentous subject, and after a great deal of discussion, in which the judges and the other law officers were afraid to give an opinion on either side, the question was compromised. It was agreed that the present king should retain the crown for his life, and that it should then pass to the Duke of York and his heirs. But the resolute queen, determined on asserting her son's right, would hear of no such thing. She came from Scotland to the north of England, where several powerful lords armed in her cause. The Duke of York, for his part, set off with some 5,000 men, a little time before Christmas Day, 1460, to give her battle. He lodged at Sandal Castle, near Wakefield, and the Red Roses defied him to come out on Wakefield Green, and fight them then and there. His general said, he had best wait until his gallant son, the Earl of March, came up with his power, but he was determined to accept the challenge. He did so, in an evil hour. He was hotly pressed on all sides. 2,000 of his men lay dead on Wakefield Green, and he himself was taken prisoner. They set him down in mock state on an anthill, and twisted grass about his head, and pretended to pay court to him on their knees, saying, O king, without a kingdom, and prince without a people, we hope your gracious majesty is very well and happy. They did worse than this. They cut his head off, and handed it on a pole to the queen, who laughed with delight when she saw it.
You recollect their walking so religiously and comfortably to St. Paul's,
comma, and had it fixed, with a paper crown upon its head, on the walls of York. The Earl of Salisbury lost his head too, and the Duke of York's second son, a handsome boy who was flying with his tutor over Wakefield Bridge, was stabbed in the heart by a murderous Lord Clifford by name, whose father had been killed by the White Roses in the fight at St. Albans. There was awful sacrifice of life in this battle, for no quarter was given, and the queen was wild for revenge. When men unnaturally fight against their own countrymen, they are always observed to be more unnaturally cruel and filled with rage than they are against any other enemy. But Lord Clifford had stabbed the second son of the Duke of York, not the first. The eldest son, Edward Earl of March, was at Gloucester, and, vowing vengeance for the death of his father, his brother, and their faithful friends, he began to march against the queen. He had to turn and fight a great body of Welsh and Irish first, who worried his advance. These he defeated in a great fight at Mortimer's Cross, near Hereford, where he beheaded a number of the Red Roses taken in battle, in retaliation for the beheading of the White Roses at Wakefield. The Queen at the next turn of beheading, having moved towards London, and falling in, between St. Albans and Barnet, with the Earl of Warwick and the Duke of Norfolk, White Roses both, who were there with an army to oppose her, and had got the King with them, she defeated them with great loss, and struck off the heads of two prisoners of note, who were in the king's tent with him, and to whom the king had promised his protection. Her triumph, however, was very short. She had no treasure, and her army subsisted by plunder. This caused them to be hated and dreaded by the people, and particularly by the London people, who were wealthy. As soon as the Londoners heard that Edward, Earl of March, united with the Earl of Warwick, was advancing towards the city, they refused to send the queen supplies, and made a great rejoicing. The queen and her men retreated with all speed, and Edward and Warwick came on, greeted with loud acclamations on every side. The courage, beauty, and virtues of young Edward could not be sufficiently praised by the whole people. He rode into London like a conqueror, and met with an enthusiastic welcome. A few days afterwards, Lord Falconbridge and the Bishop of Exeter assembled the citizens in St. John's Field, Clerkenwell, and asked them if they would have Henry of Lancaster for their king. To this they all roared, No, no, no! And King Edward. King Edward. Then, said those noblemen, would they love and serve young Edward? To this they all cried, yes, yes. And threw up their caps, and clapped their hands, and cheered tremendously. Therefore, it was declared, that by joining the queen, and not protecting those two prisoners of note, Henry of Lancaster had forfeited the crown, and Edward of York was proclaimed king. He made a great speech to the applauding people at Westminster, and sat down as sovereign of England on that throne, on the golden covering of which his father, worthy of a better fate than the bloody axe which cut the thread of so many lives in England, through so many years had laid his hand. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.